the title. I'll give three lectures on theoretical cosmology. And I spent a little bit of time thinking about whether I should give a Blackboard talk or make slides. With the Blackboard talk, obviously, you cover less, but maybe understand some of the things in more detail. Eventually, I went for the slides because I felt it's the only way to really give you an overview of theoretical cosmology in three lectures. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't ask questions, and I'm also happy to explain stuff in more detail. So you should just interrupt me if there's anything unclear or any topic that you want to hear more about. And I thought I started with a slide that you've surely seen many times, and maybe you're even tired of it. The reason I'm showing it is because I think it does a good job in summarizing what we know about the early universe. And as you see on the left, it's fuzzy, just like our understanding of the early universe. We're not really sure exactly what happened there. We have a number of ideas. Then we know that one way or another, we ended up in a very hot and dense universe. And the energy density in that universe caused the space-time to expand. The expansion of space-time caused the plasma to cool. More and more degrees of freedom freeze out. Eventually, the universe even becomes cold enough for atoms to form. This is when the photons that mediated the interactions in the plasma for the first time no longer have anyone to interact with, and the cosmic microwave background is released. This is somewhere here at 400,000 years. Then we enter the dark ages. Eventually, gravitational attractions lead to the formation of the first stars and galaxies. And here, part of the figure is illustrating that down here, you're dominated by matter. So the scale factor or the size of the universe grows like t to the 2/3. Whereas as you get out here, eventually what we call dark energy takes over and the expansion of the universe begins to accelerate. And here we are, in this case, shown as WMAP observing the whole thing. And there's a lot more that you can read out of the diagram with a little bit of fantasy, and we'll hopefully understand this diagram better throughout the lectures. But this is the basic picture that we'll try to understand in the three lectures. And we'll actually spend a fair amount of time trying to understand this stuff that you can't actually really see in the picture. So there's a lot of stuff we can already learn about the early times that is a bit hard to draw to scale in here. So I wasn't sure if everyone has taken a class on general relativity, so I wanted to at least give a little bit of a summary and introduce the notation. Who has taken a class on general relativity? That's pretty much everyone. Okay. So maybe it's still useful as a short summary. It won't take too long. The basic idea I think everyone knows is that you shouldn't think of a gravitational attraction as due to a force that's acting at a distance, like in the Newtonian theory, but you should think of it as an attraction that arises because space-time is curved. So I'm trying to illustrate that in this little picture here, something like that. I'm sure you've also seen many times. Maybe this is the sun, maybe some other star. Then the Earth orbits around the sun because it sees that the space-time near it is curved and orbits around the sun. And the geometry is determined by the matter density. So this is the basic picture. And really, for what we're saying today in about cosmology, we don't really need to know a whole lot more about general relativity than that, essentially. It gets a little bit more, you need to know a little bit more general relativity as we go to the later lectures when we discuss the perturbations. So there will be a little bit more general relativity. For now, the only thing we need to know is how to then describe the geometry of this space-time in our case. And to understand how we describe the geometry of space-time, I just wanted to remind you that this, the formalism we use, is not really the only way to describe the geometry of space or space-time. But the formulation that we're using goes back to Riemann in 1854 from his Habilitation, which I'm showing here. And the idea is that you can encode the geometry of space by giving its line element, which essentially tells you the distance between nearby points. If you've taken a class on general relativity, you know a more elegant description of that, but that's the one basic way of thinking about it, is that the distance between nearby points is, in this case, in flat space, just given by Pythagoras as dx squared plus dy squared. So this is the line element for a flat space. Whereas if you have a space that's a little bit more interesting, still very simple, but it, let's say you have a space that's a sphere, then if you want to compute the distance between a point that's at between a point with coordinates phi, theta and phi, and a point with coordinates theta plus d theta and phi plus d phi, then the distance, ds squared, is equal to this length, which is sine theta d phi squared, plus this length, which is d theta squared. So you end up with a line element on the sphere that looks like d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And what we're interested in is not so much just the geometry of space, but the geometry of space-time, but the basic idea goes through in the same way. You can define a line element of space-time that looks like this, where the only new element is that it's not really that the signature here is minus plus 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 or plus minus minus minus, depending on the preference of the lecturer. In this case, I'm using the minus plus 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 conventions. And then for the Minkowski space that you know from special relativity, you get a line element that's just minus dt squared plus dx squared. If you try to do cosmology, what you get is a line element on any given time slice. So we're working at fixed time. It's supposed to be illustrated by these galaxies. Obviously, they're not necessarily on a grid in the real world, but let's just put them on a grid in this way. Then the distance between a galaxy, we can say that the co-moving distance dx between these galaxies might be 1. So I have a distance 1 between this one, and 1 here. Then the distance between these two would just be square root of 2. So we get the co-moving distance is dx squared plus dy squared. And then to get the physical distance, we multiply by what's called a scale factor, which in this case I'm calling A1 because we're looking at the universe at some time T1. And if you go to a later time slice, let's say the galaxies moved apart from each other, the co-moving distance we can still call 1. So we'll always just label our space-time points by some galaxies, let's say. Then the co-moving distance is still dx squared, and then the scale factor has changed. So you get a ds squared is a 2 dx squared. If you put it together into a little video, you get a line element that's just minus dt squared plus a squared of t dx squared, and you just see that the space expands, and the expansion is encoded in just this function a of t. So there isn't anything else that you have to describe. That's almost true. So what I was showing you before is a flat Friedmann, Lemaitre, Robertson, Walker universe. There's a slightly more general possibility. The possibility I showed is the one that we know, or we think is the one that's realized in nature, just because data tells us that the curvature is very close to zero. But in principle, you're allowed to have a closed universe, meaning that the spatial slices are three spheres, and you're also allowed to have a hyperbolic space as your spatial slice, which would give a metric that looks like this. So for k equals 1, you might recognize this as this part here as the metric of a three-sphere, although there's maybe ways of writing the metric for the three-sphere that's more recognizable, but this is one way of writing the metric on the three-sphere, on the upper part of the three-sphere. And for k equals minus 1, it gives you a hyperbolic space. So these are the possibilities. The one we'll mostly consider is the one where k is equal to 0, just because that's what we think is consistent with the data. We have no indication that there's any non-zero k. We'll discuss it a little bit more, but for the most part, I'll always be working in the flat FRW universe. So the only thing really to specify the geometry of space-time at the level of the background, the homogeneous universe, is then the scale factor. It's just a single function, a of t, And as you can see, if you look at the metric that we had, so when you have ds squared is minus dt squared plus a squared dx squared, then you see that the scale factor or the value of the scale factor itself can't really be physical because you can just rescale coordinates to absorb any constant. So the only thing that's physical in a flat FRW universe are things like the fractional rate of change of the scale factor, which is the Hubble rate, or the ratio of scale factors at different times. So here I'm showing, for example, a of t divided by a of t0. T0 I'll often use to denote the time at the present. And then t is some time of interest, the time when some galaxy emits the light that we see today, for example. And then this quantity, this ratio of scale factors at different times, is often also written as 1 over 1 plus z, where z is called the redshift. And the next thing we'll try to understand is why this z is called the redshift. Yeah?
So in the case of a non-spatially flat universe, the physical quantity will no longer be related to its normalization?
I mean, in that case, you can have a notion of a scale just because the sphere may have a minimum size or something like this. I mean, these are still meaningful quantities, but there is then a physical scale. I mean, the size of the sphere or the radius of curvature of the hyperbolic space. I mean, it doesn't mean these are still the quantities we'll be discussing, but in a flat universe, those are really the only things. In the other case, just we haven't yet gotten there, but if you look at the Friedmann equation, there is a term that's k over a squared, and so that gives you some physical scale and some meaning to what a is.
I had a quick question on the previous slide.
Yeah?
Okay.
This one?
Yes. Are you using k is dimensionless, right?
K is dimensionless, yeah.
So we've got one minus dimensionless thing times the square of a dimensionful thing.
Well, right now you may argue that my coordinates are a little bit funny, but these are also dimensionless.
Okay.
So I'm using the x's to be dimensionless, and the dimension right now is carried by the scale factor.
Okay. Essentially, you can set the scale of A to make K if it's not zero, either plus one or minus one.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you could scale if you could rescale the coordinates that you want, but then the K would.
Then the K wouldn't be one, so there could be some. Could be different from one, then you can absorb that scale into A to set it to one. So in general, yeah, when you write down the sphere, this is really a three sphere with curvature radius one. So there's, I mean, this is how, in general, if you have a different radius, then the radius would appear in here.
Is that quantity the top squared? X
dot dx, that is squared. The whole thing is squared. So yeah. It's x dot dx squared. So there's a square missing, sorry. Thanks. Any other questions? Okay, so now let's try to understand why I was calling it the redshift. And to understand that, let's see how particles behave in this FRW universe. And a particle, as you may know from if all taken general relativity, essentially, so you know that the action of a point particle looks like this. It's just, there's a, depending on, so I'm setting c equals 1 throughout, so there would otherwise be a c here. And so you get this version of the action. There's other ways of writing the action. But if you take this action, derive the equations of motion, so just write down the Euler-Lagrange equations for this action, you get what is called the geodesic equation, where this gamma here, the Christoffel symbols, which are given in terms of the metric in this way. So that's what the geodesic equation looks like in a general spacetime. In the FRW universe, it simplifies. So again, here I'm using the flat FRW universe. Otherwise, there's contributions proportional to k in there. But for a flat FRW universe, if you write down the geodesic equation, you get these two equations. We'll be interested in this one here, in the spatial components, and we'll rewrite it slightly by using the chain rule. So these dots are the derivatives with respect to tau, so the affine parameter here. We'll change variables using the chain rule and write d by d tau as d by dx naught d by dt times d by dt, and then you see that this equation just takes this form. And from this equation, now you see that this you can easily solve it. So h, remember, is a dot over a. So if you look at that equation, maybe bring it to the other side so it's easier to recognize, but you have some quantity dot is equal to minus a dot minus 2a dot over a times the quantity, which means that that quantity scales like 1 over a squared. So you have dxi by d tau must be proportional to 1 over a squared from the geodesic equation. And what you can do is to define the momentum of the particle. So the momentum is, as usual, is defined as just the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the four velocity in this case. So you get the four momentum as the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the four velocity. And you can work it out. You just get this, this quantity. And you can also, you're free to choose the affine parameter to what's most convenient for you. You can, often it's convenient to choose it so that this thing is equal to 1. Obviously, there are some limitations, but you can choose it so that that thing is equal to 1. Then the four momentum takes the simpler form, and you can compute the magnitude of the three momentum, so p sub I, which is just gij x dot j. Gij, we know, is just a squared delta ij. But in any case, if you then take the magnitude, which is you get by contracting it with the three metric, you get that the magnitude of the three momentum is given by this. This guy, you know, is the metric, so it scales like a squared times delta ij. This one scales like 1 over a squared, so these cancel. This guy scales like 1 over a squared. If you take the square root, this goes like 1 over a. So the momentum of a particle in an FRW universe goes like the 1 over the scale factor. So as the universe expands, a particle, the momentum of a particle, we say redshift, so the energy of the particle goes down. And so if you have a particle that's emitted with some momentum p at some time t, then if you observe it at some later time, let's say today, let's say there's a supernova that goes off at some time t, and it emits some particle with a momentum p, if we measure that particle today, its momentum is somewhat lower than when it was emitted. It's lower by exactly this factor, and that's what's called the redshift. So the momentum is redshifted and for the particle, and typically the nomenclature comes from massless particles. The action I wrote is for massless particle, for massive particles, but you can write an action also for massless particles, and everything I was saying goes through in the same way. For massless particles, you also know that the momentum is proportional to the frequency. So this equation then tells you that the frequency, in this case, redshifts. It just means that the spectral lines shift to longer wavelength. So that's the origin of the redshift. Does that make sense? Are there any questions? Okay, so what we'll try to understand now is how we actually measure the expansion, the scale factor or the expansion rate. And for if we're interested in it in nearby events, so events that happened relatively recently, not too far from us, what we can do is we can expand the scale factor around the present time. So you take the scale factor at some time t is the scale factor today plus, and then we just do a Taylor series expansion. And if the redshift is much less than 1, maybe I can write it down, but I think it's probably clear. So here what I'm doing is I'm dividing both sides by t0. So I'm using a of t0 is equal to 1 plus, and then this one is h0 times t minus t0. This thing we were just defining as 1 over 1 plus z, which is for small redshifts, just 1 minus z, so we have 1 minus z is equal to 1 plus h naught t minus t0. The ones cancel, and you see that the redshift is just h times t0 minus t, so this is again the time today, or the age of the universe today, minus the time or the age of the universe at the time when the photon was emitted. This is also the, I'm setting the speed of light to 1. I mentioned that earlier, so just keep that in mind. So then this is also the distance the photon traveled. And so you see that the redshift is equal to the Hubble rate at the present times the distance between us and the object. And the distance is a positive quantity. So if you have an expanding universe, you should predominantly see galaxies with positive redshifts. If you're in a contracting universe, you should predominantly see galaxies with negative redshifts. So from the sign, you can tell what the universe is doing. And this is what Vesto Melvin-Slipher first measured. So he was the first to measure spectra of galaxies. And here I'm showing you the data or his measurements. And you see that except for two galaxies, indeed, he saw that all the other ones have positive redshifts. And he didn't really interpret it in terms of the expansion of the universe in that paper, but we now know that this is due to the expansion of the universe. And obviously, we have taken spectra of many, many more galaxies, millions of galaxies, and all but the nearest few have redshifts. So we're clearly in an expanding universe. If we want to go beyond just telling whether the universe is expanding or contracting, what we have to do, we have to be able to measure the distance. So remember that we had Hubble's law written as h naught times d. So if I want to do more than just measure the sign of it, I have to actually be able to measure distances. I won't say all too much about it, but there's a few things that are worth remembering. So one way to measure distances directly is through parallax. So this is just one way to think. There's different ways of using parallax. One is just using the motion of the Earth around the Sun, and if you measure the position of stars in the spring, you'll see versus the fall, you see that some of the stars appear to move around by a small amount. The further the star is away, it's just like looking at your thumb with one eye and then the other eye. The closer the star is, the more it appears to move, and this motion is the the traditional parallax. In cosmology, that's typically not too useful, although with Gaia now, there's much better data for stars in the Milky Way. But anything further away, typically you want to use other ways of measuring distance. One way to measure distance is by measuring how bright an object is. Let's imagine you have an object whose absolute luminosity you know, so you know how much light the object emits. It's somewhere away from you. You know how much it emits. You know how much you receive. By energy conservation, you know that the flux you receive should be the luminosity divided by the area of the sphere, which is just 4 pi times the distance squared. This is true in Euclidean space. In the FRW universe, what happens is that there's two corrections to this. One is because if the object that you're observing is far enough away, the photons are redshifted. So there's one factor just because the energy goes down because of the redshift. Then there's another factor of 1 plus z that arises because the rate of change at which the photons arrive here is lower than the rate at which photons were emitted at the source. So there's 2 powers of 1 plus z in the denominator here in this equation. And so you see that the luminosity distance in general relativity in an FRW universe is just a zero, so the scale factor today, times the co-moving distance to the object times 1 plus z. So that's one quantity that we'll discuss more because that's, yeah?
Can you repeat the statement about the second factor, 1 plus z? Let's just say something about the rate of photon emission being...
Yeah. Yeah, let's say the source emits at some frequency, then you see that redshifted as well. So that appears lower.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then another way to measure the distances is if you have an object of a known size, so you know that something is like is a meter stick and you can place it away from you, you can measure its angular size in a Euclidean universe that just gives you the size is the angle it subtends in the sky times the distance. So obviously I'm assuming I'm in the small angle approximation. Cosmology, again, there's another factor of 1 over 1 plus z, not so much. Really, what this guy is that this the size of the object at the time it's emitted. So if you look at the metric, it's minus dt squared plus, let's say, a squared dr squared. And then you're interested times r squared, a squared, r squared, d theta squared. You're interested in a at the time when the light is emitted, which is related to the scale factor today by 1 over 1 plus z. So that's where this 1 over 1 plus z comes from in the relation for the angular diameter distance. And this would all be nice if we could just place objects out there of known luminosities and known sizes, but we can't really distribute them throughout the universe. So we have to look for things that we can use, meaning we have to look for things that can serve as standard candles, so some events out there that whose absolute luminosity we somehow know or can calibrate. And I'll discuss a little bit variable stars like Cepheids. These are nice. One of the problems with them is that you can't see them all too far out, so really you want to have objects that are further out. The ones that are mostly used are type 1a supernovae in this case. For standard rulers, there's what are called baryon acoustic oscillations. We'll discuss them later when we look at fluctuations. This is a feature in the correlation function of galaxies, and this is a physical distance, the co-moving sound horizon at decoupling, that you can measure at different at redshifts and extract something about the expansion history of the universe. So we have something like a standard ruler. Then in the future, so far there's one event. Eventually there will be more events that can be used as standard sirens, which are gravitational wave events with electromagnetic counterparts. So here from the gravitational wave event, what you know is how much energy was emitted. What you don't know is what the redshift was from the gravitational wave data alone. So you need some electromagnetic counterpart to measure the redshift of the event. If you can do both of them, then you can measure the luminosity distance as a function of redshift with these. For the standard candles, the important work was done by Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who was studying stars in the Magellanic Clouds. And here I'm showing you a table from her 1908 paper of Cepheid. So she really was observing these stars for an extended period of time, measuring their luminosity, the apparent luminosities. These are magnitudes, so the smaller the number, the brighter. So the larger number, the dimmer. And then she was measuring also their periods. So these are periods measured in days. And then you see that some of the Cepheids here that have the smaller numbers, which means Cepheids that are brighter, typically have longer periods. So they between different peaks of their light curves, more time passes for the brighter ones, the dimmer ones. Here, let's say 16, magnitude 16, is shorter. So this is also something she pointed out, is whether you've noticed that in table 6, the brighter variables have the longer periods. And so you can try to use that to calibrate them. The reason the reason this was so useful is because they're all in the Magellanic Cloud, so you know that they're all roughly at the same physical distance. You know that this is really some intrinsic property of the object, and you can also make plots of this, and you see that if you make a log-log plot, the period and the luminosity nicely correlate. So with these kind of stars, you can try to measure. Yeah.
How did they calculate the distance to the Magellanic Cloud in the first place?
So the distance to the Magellanic Clouds, you can try to get through. I mean, usually the distances ultimately are always measured relative to some parallax measurements. So you always have to be able to measure some parallax to some objects.
I just thought they were really far to use parallax. But again, like, you can use parallax.
Well, you don't need to know the, I mean, here so far I haven't said anything about the zero level calibration. So here I'm just showing you this relation. The point is not that you don't have to know the distance. You don't have to know the distance to it. You just have to know that all these stars are at the same distance. Okay. So you just have to be able to tell that they're all in the same Magellanic Cloud. So they're either all in the small or large Magellanic Cloud. I mean, she was looking at 1,800 stars, some of them in the small Magellanic Cloud, some of them in the large Magellanic Cloud. And then you just look at them and you know that they're all in the same object. So the distance between us and those stars, even if we don't know, is all the same. I mean, close to the same. Obviously, the clouds also have some sizes, but it's not enough to explain this kind of difference. So the point isn't that here you know the absolute zero level, but the point is that you know this relation holds for these stars. It doesn't yet allow you to measure an absolute distance at all. You still have to then measure some Cepheids with parallax, and there are measurements. It's not easy, so I have the next guy spend more time on that. This is Shapley, spent more time on really measuring the parallaxes of these things. They're not measured in the traditional way I was describing earlier, where you measure the star, the position of the star in the sky in the spring, and then the position of the star in the fall. But you're using really a different type of parallax where you're using that the solar system is moving and you see that there's a solar apex and the stars, depending on their distance, appear to be moving away from that solar apex faster or slower in the sky. And this is what was used to calibrate the distances to the Cepheids. So this is not then done with the same set. There's, does it make sense? I mean, you have to measure the absolute distance to some of these Cepheids with parallax.
Yeah.
And then once you know that, you know the distances to other Cepheids, assuming that they're all the same, which is what Hubble was assuming and why he got his Hubble constant off by so much. I mean, they're also not all the same. There's different populations. But so this is exactly what he was doing. So he's measuring the distances of these things. So once you've calibrated them, you can then try to use them. This is what Hubble was trying to do, to use them to measure the distance to M31 and M33. And so here is the first time you have these Cepheids resolved there and measure their periods. And the problem, as I said, so what you can then do is you have a measurement of the distance using the Cepheids. You have a measurement of the redshifts. So you can try to make a Hubble diagram. This is what's called the Hubble diagram, plotting the redshift and the distance. The slope is the Hubble parameter. And if you just do that for the diagram in his paper, you get a slope of about 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. This is also, I mean, the reason we're using these funny units is because it's coming from this diagram. So there's kilometers per second for the velocity, and there's parsecs. Otherwise, obviously, it's really just a rate. But the reason it's written in this funny way is because we're in the back of your mind, you think of it as a Hubble diagram. So there's the velocity here, the distance here, and this is the slope. And there's a number of reasons, but one of the reason this number was off is what I was just saying. So not all Cepheids are really the same. There's different populations of stars. This was a long debate with Bade. And eventually became clear that really the Cepheids Hubble was looking at are very different from the Cepheids that Henrietta Swan Leavitt was observing, which is why the calibration was off. Here, if you want to look at some of the light curves, so these are Cepheid light curves, so the magnitudes as a function of time for a number of Cepheids measured with HST. So this is what something like that looks like, and you see that they're clearly periodic. You can try to measure their period, and you can try to measure their magnitude and make these kind of diagrams and try to calibrate them. And you have...
I don't understand what the top right, the top left one, is it terrible?
The top left one.
The top right, so the red one on the left.
The red one on the left. I mean, some of them look okay, then this one.
It kind of looks like by eye, like.
I mean, the data
shorter
isn't.
Period, and that's trying to tell me.
This thing you're saying.
Yeah. And then there's like.
And then there's a double dip. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. This, in any case, is what the data looks like.
Okay.
So you get
even the points at the top look very much, if you just shift them over, they seem to fit very well. Is that really new points on the right?
It's supposed to be new points. It's not my data at all. I mean, this is from the HSD paper. I have nothing to do with this measurement. I agree with you that these look like they're just mirrored over here. I don't know. We can ask them. I mean, I agree that they just look mirrored. Yeah. Yeah?
Just because you talk about error bars on these plots, what do you have any estimate what Hubble's error bars would have been in 1919 if you would make?
So I actually don't know. I mean, if you look at other papers from that period, they are aware that you should be putting error bars. So if you look at if you look at this paper, for example, he spends a great deal of time discussing what the uncertainties are and so on. So I don't know why he didn't put them, if it's that he himself didn't believe it or wasn't sure how big the uncertainties are. I mean, I don't know why he didn't put them.
I can volunteer a single piece of information about this. A bunch of those aren't individual objects. He decided arbitrarily that things that were close together on the sky were close together in fact. And so that made error bar calculation extremely difficult because, like, he's decided these three objects are one thing on his plot. And that might have been a case of... I don't know what the uncertainty on the overall thing is because they were complicated individuals, but...
Yeah, the...
He was doing a lot of weird things on this plot.
Question remains...
Mislabeled the axes.
Mislabeled the
axes. Kilometers, not kilometers.
Yeah, but this is common somehow. Also, if you look at other papers from that time, I think even some of the other ones I showed before, they always give the velocity in kilometers, implying that it's kilometers per second. I don't know why this is what they were doing, but... that seems to be pretty common. I think I have others where that happened. Yeah, I think also the Slipher paper had this same thing. So here also he says the velocity is 400 kilometers. I don't know. So I guess some things have changed since then. I don't know, but... Anyway, so I don't know why he didn't put error bars. So other people at the time put error bars. I don't know if this is his personal style or he was unsure what to put as error bars. I don't really know.
Would you estimate 500 plus minus 500 or 500?
Oh, I mean, I think... No, I mean, it's not 500 plus minus 500. I mean, you're clearly measuring a slope here. I mean, it's not that this is consistent with zero or something like that. That's not the case. I mean, one of the things is really just that the Cepheids were different Cepheids, different metallicities. So the one is population one and the other one is population two. So that really screws up that number. And then the other thing is that these objects are really, in a sense, too close. It's not even clear you should be necessarily using these objects for a Hubble diagram. But I mean, just because there's intrinsic motion. Okay, so this is for the nearby stuff. If you want to go out further, you can't directly measure the Cepheids anymore. You can't measure light curves of Cepheids. So you want to have distance indicators that you can use to higher redshifts. And the most popular ones are the type 1a supernovae. Here I'm showing one such supernova. So it's an explosion of a star that becomes as bright as, or can be as bright for a short period of time as the host galaxy. Now, you might ask how you can possibly use this as a distance indicator because you just see something blink and you don't really know naively what exploded. The reason you can use it is that you can measure more of that thing. You can measure the spectrum. I didn't put it anywhere, but this is all 1994A. So the what you can measure is the spectrum, and you see silicon lines, some sulfur lines, iron lines, very different from other types of supernovae. So this is why it's called type 1A supernova. It's based on the spectrum. This is a pretty characteristic spectrum. You see no hydrogen or helium lines, but you see silicon and iron lines, and this tells you a little bit about what the star is that's exploding. And for these, the idea is that what is exploding is a white dwarf, so something like the sun might end up being at some point. And the idea here is that these are stars, or one of the ideas is that these are stars that are in a binary system. So you have a white dwarf with a companion. There's mass flowing from the companion onto the white dwarf, which pushes it over the Chandrasekhar limit and then eventually explodes, which means it always roughly explodes when it has the same mass. That's not entirely true, so they're not literally standard candles in the sense that they're all equally bright, but you can at least use them or use the shape of the light curves to calibrate them. So there's a single parameter that's called the stretch factor that you can use to calibrate these supernovae. And once you know the luminosity, so the way this here is describing the measurement of the Hubble parameter, or one way these are used for the measurement of the Hubble parameter, this is from the paper by Riesedahl. So the idea is that you have some host galaxies with supernovae where you also have Cepheids, so you can measure a distance to these hosts with Cepheids, which allows you to calibrate the absolute luminosity of the supernovae. And then once you know the absolute luminosity of the supernovae, you can then use additional supernovae for which you don't really know the distance because you don't have Cepheids in the same host. But for them, you just have to measure the flux. So once you have calibrated the luminosity for them, for the remaining ones where you don't have an absolute measurement, just the measurement of the flux is enough, and you can use, in that paper, 300 supernovae for that. Obviously, the way I'm describing it as this two-stage fit, it's not literally how it's done. It's done in one global fit, but that's the basic idea. So you use Cepheids to measure the luminosity of the supernovae in hosts where you have both, and then you just measure the flux of the supernovae in hosts where you don't have Cepheids to beat down the systematic uncertainties, and you get a measurement of the Hubble rate that's 73 plus minus 2, let's say, in this case. So that's one way of using these standard candles. If we're trying to go beyond measuring just exactly what the scale factor and its derivative are doing, we'll try to have to introduce the matter into the picture. In the matter, in general relativity, obviously appears in the field equation. So it determines, as we said, the matter determines the curvature of space-time. The proper way of writing it as an equation is this. So you have the Ricci tensor, which I'm writing out here explicitly in terms of the Christoffel symbol, and the Ricci scalar. So this combination is equal to 8 pi g times t mu nu. Here I'm including a cosmological constant. Often I'll be thinking of it as a vacuum energy and just move it to the other side and just call it vacuum energy rather than cosmological constant. So then you would just have the Einstein tensor equals to 8 pi g t mu nu, with the understanding that t mu nu can have a piece that's just proportional to the metric. And so here t mu nu is obviously what's telling you what the matter content is. And if we go back to so this was the general description. If we go back to our flat FRW universe, then the symmetries of the space-time tell us that the stress tensor must be of this form. So the T0i component must vanish because it would single out a preferred direction. So these components have to be zero, the T00 component can only be a function of time, and then the Tij component in general has to be proportional to the metric, so it should be Gij essentially times P, or in the flat FRW universe, it's just A squared delta Ij times P. If you compute these quantities, so if you compute the Einstein tensor and you compute the work out what the field equations look like, they just become, the 0,0 component just becomes what's known as the Friedmann equation. H squared is 8 pi g over 3 times rho, and the ij, the space components, become 3h squared plus 2h dot is minus 8 pi g times the pressure. And they imply a conservation equation. You can easily see that because you can just take the time derivative here, so you get 2h h dot is equal to 8 pi g over 3 times rho dot, and then you can eliminate the, you can use this quantity, this equation to eliminate h dot here and write h squared in terms of rho, and you arrive at this equation. So you get rho dot plus 3h rho plus p is equal 0, and you can use either one, so it doesn't matter which one you use. You can use this combination if you want, or you can use, this is what's usually used, the Friedmann equation together with the continuity equation. And what you see is that here we have two equations, two independent equations for the scale factor, the density, and the pressure. So we need one additional constraint for the system of equations to close. Yeah?
You said that you get the stress energy tensor from symmetry arguments. Like, is that just like another theorem argument? And that's how you get that form of Tij?
It's not really a Noether's theorem to me, as far as I can tell. It's just a statement of what form the tensor has to take to respect those symmetries. So if you want the system to have the same symmetries as the metric, this is what it has to look like. I mean, for the you can obviously write it in other coordinates. This is a statement really about in the coordinates we've been using, it has to have this form. But Noether's theorem, to me, is the statement that if the action has a symmetry or continuous symmetry, then you get a conserved quantity. It's not really what I'm using directly here. So here, it's just the statement that if you want the system or the equations to have the same symmetries. I mean, you have to have objects with the same symmetries on the left and right. And so this is the only form it can take. So here the statement is just that if this were non-zero, it would single out a direction. Whatever this vector is, it singles out a preferred direction, which we know can't be there. So that part has to be zero. And then we were also saying that the spaces we're looking at, the three sphere, the Euclidean space, the homogeneous, the hyperbolic space, they're all homogeneous spaces, so they have no preferred point anywhere. So it cannot really depend on x in this case here, and the pressure can't depend on x in general. The metric here could depend on x. But so this is not really Noether's theorem, it's just a statement about the symmetries of the tensor.
Well, it presumably goes to observations that the universe looks pretty homogeneous and isotropic, and therefore you assume that the metric is homogeneous and isotropic.
Yeah, the metric, but I thought this was the question about the stress tensor. So we're assuming that the metric is homogeneous and isotropic, and then to find a solution of the equations, I mean, to have a consistent set of equations, the source also has to look like this.
Maybe it's different from Noether's, is that there's no Einstein's equations don't tell you that the metric is homogeneous and isotropic, but that seems to fit observations well, so you assume that it's homogeneous and isotropic for the metric, and then of course
for the metric we're assuming it, and then here this is an additional statement that the right hand side has to have the same symmetries as the left hand side. It's really just what it's saying. I mean, otherwise you won't be able to solve the equations. I mean, they're not consistent. Okay, and so you need some equation of state, means you have to have a pressure expressed in terms of the density in some way or form to close the system. And this means that you have to somehow say more about what the matter is that you're actually putting in. So you have to be able to compute for the matter content what the pressure is, let's say. And one common thing, so it's not the only thing we'll be interested in, but one thing that reappears many, many times is just a system of particles. And so we should work out what the equation of state is for a gas of particles. And we saw that the action for a single particle was just m times dt times the square root of minus g mu x dot nu. And if you have a bunch of non-interacting particles, then the action is just the sum of the individual, the one particle actions. So that's what I'm writing here. And now the question is, what's the stress tensor? Because we're trying to figure out what is the energy density, what is the pressure. If you want to work out the stress tensor, you just compute the variation of this gadget with respect to the metric, essentially. Does that make sense? So you just compute the variation, you get the stress tensor, you find that the stress tensor looks like this. So really, when you do the calculation, here you want to write it as an integral d4x times the delta function, because the stress tensor is the thing that appears in the variation of the four-dimensional action. So you want to write this integral d4x times the delta function. That's where this delta function is coming from. And then this piece you can see is really just the functional derivative with respect to the metric. You get 1 over 2 times the square root times, when you take the derivative here, you just get this piece. This is here to make it generally covariant. And then this is the stress tensor for a system of non-interacting particles. And we defined the momentum earlier, so we can we can write it in terms of the momenta. And what's also makes it slightly easier to look at is if we're integrating over the affine parameter. So we're integrating over the affine parameter to make the stress tensor for a gas of particles look like this. So it's not surprising that it's only non-zero where the particle is. So xa of t is the position of the particle as a function of time. There's a delta function for that. And then it's p mu, p nu over p zero. So if you look at t zero, zero, it's just the p zeros cancel. It's just p zero. It's just the energy. That's what you would have expected. And if you take the ij components, you see that you also just get the right pieces. The p zero, I should have maybe said, is given by this. So this is just the usual statement that E squared is P squared plus M squared. So I have a bunch of particles that are labeled by some label A, and then each one of them has a trajectory, which I call XA of T. And then XI, so this is a function on tensor that depends on position. And the x is the argument here.
I see.
And the xa is the trajectory of the particle.
So that's just saying only evaluate the summation is only non-zero when you're evaluating at the place where there is a particle.
Correct, yeah. So there's only energy where the particle is. That's what it's saying. I mean, if you're somewhere in space, let's say the hockey stick is here, then the stress tensor from the hockey stick here is zero. So it's only when you're on the hockey stick that it's non-zero. Does that make sense? That's what the delta function is saying. Okay, so let's assume we have some fixed species of particles like electrons or protons, so they all have the same mass. Then what we can do is we can write it slightly differently by integrating over the phase space density, p mu, p nu over p zero, where the phase space density is just the sum over A, the delta function in space times the delta function in time. So you see that if you do the p integral, you just get back to the previous equation. But if you have a gas of particles, it's often convenient to think about it in this way, with n being the phase space density, meaning that n times d3x d3p tells you how many particles there are at position x between x and x plus dx with momenta between p and p plus dp. So that's what the phase-based density is telling you, and this is what the stress tensor looks like for that. Does that make sense? So you're just really summing them all up. Now, again, for the symmetries of FRW, we know that the phase-based density, again, it can't depend on position, otherwise you have more particles here than there and the universe wouldn't be homogeneous. So it can't depend on x, and it really can only depend on the magnitude of the momentum. So it has to be a function of just the magnitude of the momentum and t. And so the stress tensor eventually for our system of particles, assuming that they're homogeneous and their momentum distribution is isotropic, has to look like this. And so you see that, as expected, the time-space component vanishes because you get p0 here, pi here, and you get an integral over some function that's only a function of the magnitude times the momentum vector. So this averages to zero, so this is good. And then if you look at t0, 0, you just get that the energy density is integral d3p times the density of particles with momenta between p and p plus dp times the energy. So this is also what you would have expected. You're just summing up the energies. The pressure you just have here, you get for tij. So for the pressure, we're looking at the ij component. For tij, we get pi pj in an integral d3p pi pj. You can replace as 1/3 delta ij times p squared. And so you can write, this is the 1/3 here, and so you can write the pressure in this form. Then the stress tensor is, as we were saying, a squared delta ij times p. So this is just the definition of the momentum. So we can, yeah?
Are we discarding the local variations from homogeneity because we're assuming FLRW, or because they're negligible as compared to overall?
Both. I mean, the reason we're organizing it the way we're doing now, where we're first looking at the homogeneous FRW universe and then adding perturbations, is because, at least in the early universe, that's a very good description. So we're really treating everything in perturbation theory. So we're right now working out the background, and then later on we'll discuss the fluctuation. So right now for the background, we're setting it to zero. Then later on, if we want to study the anisotropies in the CMB, for example, or look at galaxy distributions, then we have to put this back. So that eventually we'll allow fluctuations. Okay, so what we can do is take two limits of it, but will be interesting. First, we can so this is the general form. It holds whether the particles are relativistic or not. The first thing we can consider are non-relativistic particles, by which I mean that the distribution function vanishes unless p is less than the mass. If that's the case, then in here, the integral is suppressed except for small p, so we can expand this, we can expand this guy. And so you see that for the first piece, you just get the mass times the number density, which is also what you would have expected. If you have a bunch of non-relativistic particles that are distributed in space, the energy density should just be the mass times the number density. And then the pressure is p squared over m, which is small because, I mean, this is of order v squared. So this is much less than the energy density. And typically what we then say for non-relativistic particles is that we have an energy density that's the mass times the density and a pressure that's approximately zero. So that's the equation of state, if you wish, for the non-relativistic particles. For the relativistic particles, the integration should be dominated by a region in momentum space where the momentum is large compared to the mass, so we can drop the mass in the general expression. And we just get that the energy density, again, is what we would have expected because this is the energy for a relativistic particle, and the pressure is just 1/3 that. So in this case, we get that the pressure is 1/3 times the energy density. So that's the equation of state for the relativistic particles. And then I was briefly mentioning it earlier, so we can move the cosmological constant into the vacuum energy or think of it as vacuum energy, then we can write T mu nu is just minus the energy density times rho. So we get that T zero zero is rho, Tij is minus A squared delta ij rho V. So here I'm just really reading off that G zero zero is minus one and Gij is A squared delta ij, which means that the pressure is equal to minus the energy density. So these are the kind of equations of state we're considering, and this is why they're typically just written as P is equal to W times rho. So often when people say an equation of state, this is, in cosmology, this is what they mean, the equation of state. Sometimes also W is called the equation of state. Obviously W itself is not an equation of state, but this is what people mean. So it's the pressure is equal to W times rho. And with this, you can easily solve the continuity equation. So if you remember, the continuity equation was just 3H rho plus P equal to zero. If this is if this is W times rho, you just get 3 times 1 plus WH times rho. And you can find that you see that the solution is given by this. So it just scales like 1 over A to the 3 times 1 plus W, which means that for W equals 0, for pressureless dust, it just scales like 1 over A cubed, which is what you should have expected, because if you have a certain volume with particles in there, if you don't change the number of particles, just make the volume bigger, the total energy didn't change, but the volume went up. If it goes up by a factor of, if you increase the size by a factor of 2, the volume goes up by a factor of 8. So this is the cube here, is just the volume factor. For radiation, if it's 1/3, you get 4/3 times 3 is 4. The reason there's another power is because as the universe expands, the energy of your quanta redshifts, so you get one more power of the scale factor. And then for vacuum energy, W is minus 1. There's no scaling with the scale factor, and it's just a constant. Okay, so if you then have a universe that has more than one component, I mean, right now, from what I've said, we don't yet know what the various components are, but I'm writing the ones we think are there, then you just have the Friedmann equation of this form. You have h squared is 8 pi g over 3 times the total energy density, which is just the energy density in the different components, in this case, matter, radiation, and vacuum energy, where rho matter, as we said, scales like A naught over A cubed, and typically it's written as omega matter times rho critical. So this is that at the present time, this omega matter tells you how much of the energy density is stored in matter. This is what fraction is stored in radiation, and this tells you what fraction of the energy density is stored in in dark energy. So these are what the Friedmann equation becomes. And you can also plug it back in and then solve for if you plug these in here, it just gives you an ordinary differential equation for the scale factor. You can't really solve it analytically for this kind of matter content, but it's straightforward to solve numerically and for certain simplifications. So if you're in a regime where early enough, so this doesn't matter, then you can solve it analytically and so on. So there's relatively simple solutions to this. The question then becomes, how do we actually know what the composition of the universe is? So what's there in the universe? And that's what we'll discuss next and in the next little while. So one thing we know is that there's matter. We certainly know there's the ordinary matter. We see the stars and galaxies, but it turns out there's some additional stuff. And I put Fritz Zwicky's picture here because he was the first who pointed that out. And his observations were observations of the Coma cluster, which I'm showing you here. So this is if you want to play with it, you can easily get the data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, for example. It's easy to redo the measurements now. And what he was doing is he was observing the redshifts of galaxies in the Coma cluster. And here is some of his data. So he's telling you the angular size, how many there are in the in different clusters. Here is the coma cluster. In different clusters, he's telling you how many of objects he has, what's the typical redshifts or velocities. And what you can do with this, or what was the surprise, is that these were moving much faster than you would have expected them to move. And to understand a little bit better the background, let's look at the virial theorem in general. So far, it doesn't have anything to do with cosmology, but let's say you have some system of particles in Newtonian mechanics. So then the equation of motion for that equations of motion for that system of particles just looks like this. And what you can do is just dot into this equation with the radius vector for the eighth particle and sum over A. So this equation certainly implies this equation. Then this guy is just an operator that measures how this function scales. So if you have a function that's homogeneous of degree n, this operator just gives you n times the function. And so that equation for a homogeneous potential, which is the case for Newtonian potential, it just gives you, in this case, n would be minus 1, so it would just give you v. And then on the left-hand side, we're still left with this term. We can rewrite this term slightly to make it more useful. We can write this term by just writing it as d by dt squared of mRa squared minus twice the kinetic energy. So the kinetic energy is just the usual thing. It's the sum over all the particles, 1/2 mAra dot squared. And then for gravitational interaction, when n is minus 1, you just get an equation that says 2t plus v is equal to this object here. And this is the variance of r squared. So you say if the system is in virial equilibrium, these moments of the distribution shouldn't change anymore. So this thing goes to 0. And you just get this statement for the virial theorem. And for a virialized cluster of galaxies, so now this previous thing was general. For a virialized, this is also strictly speaking still general, but this is, will it be interested in it for galaxies now? It tells you that the velocity dispersion is given by gm times the average of 1 over r, where m should be naively the mass of all galaxies, if that's all there is. And so you just count how many galaxies there are, what their typical masses are, and you know what the size of the object is, because you have some notion how far away it is from its redshift. And Zwicky estimated that for coma, just based on the masses of galaxies in the cluster, the dispersion should be 80. Well, here obviously the units aren't right, so this should be the square root of this. So the velocity dispersion should be 80 kilometers per second, whereas the observed dispersion is 900 kilometers per second. So they're moving much faster than you would have thought based on just the mass that's there in galaxies. And so he concluded that there has to somehow be dunkle materie, or dark matter, in the coma cluster with a density that's much higher than the baryonic density. Another piece of evidence that there's this dark matter around comes from Vera Rubin's work, who was measuring rotation curves of spiral galaxies. So if you have edge-on spiral galaxies, you can measure the radial velocities of stars and H2 regions in these galaxies. According to Newton, you know the centripetal force is provided by gravity, so you just get v squared is equal gm over r, which means that if you look at stuff that's beyond the disk, so she was looking at H2 regions that are beyond the disk of what looks like the disk where all the stars are, you expect the mass to eventually just be constant, and you expect the velocity to go down, or at least not. You expect it to decrease. And so here is her abstract. And these are some of the measurements. So these are H2 regions. This is M31, the Andromeda. And she measured the radial velocities for all these objects and made a rotation curve, and looks like this. And there's no indication that this goes down. You might have said, well, maybe there's something funny going on in one spiral galaxy, so you definitely want to look at more of them. But there's no indication that the rotation curve of any of the galaxies we're aware of really behaves like you would have expected in the absence of dark matter. So there should be some additional stuff out there in beyond the disk of the galaxy. There's still matter that accounts for these rotation curves. That's the interpretation. There's other indications just from trying to form galaxies in numerical simulations. If you look at spirals and all you have are baryons, they don't really seem to form spiral galaxies. This is a paper that I'm just quoting here. They typically form bars, so it's grossly unstable to bar-like mode, so the spiral galaxies wouldn't look like our spiral galaxies. So far, all of these could just be some form of non-luminous matter. It doesn't mean so far that the matter is different from the baryonic matter we see. It could just be dark, well, some tennis balls or stuff floating around that you can't see. So the question is it baryonic matter or is it something else? And there's also good evidence that it isn't baryonic matter. It has to be something else. One piece of evidence comes from X-ray observations of clusters. So the gas in a cluster of galaxies, you expect it to emit X-rays. So let's say you have protons in between the galaxies or hydrogen. The gravitational wells are so deep that the energies are high enough, so you can just estimate them for a typical mass of a galaxy cluster and its size. You expect velocities of 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light, so you expect kinetic energies of a few keV. So if these things collide, you should be able to see this in X-ray. And of course, because it's a two-particle interaction, the luminosity that you expect is proportional to the baryon density times some function for the interaction that you can compute as a function of temperature. But you expect to see X-ray emission from these clusters. And just as a little bit of background, so if you assume that these are in hydrostatic equilibrium, which may or may not be a terribly good approximation, but let's assume just for simplicity that they're in hydrostatic equilibrium for a second, then the pressure balances the gravitational pull. So this is, you can write it in this way. So this is, if you think of a shell at radius r, between r and r plus dr, there's the pressure pushing in, pushing out, and then there's the gravitational attraction, which looks like this. This is just the mass in the interior of the shell, and this is the mass of the shell that you're interested in. Again, you have to specify, this is just one equation, so again, you have to specify some equation of state. In this case, well, let's assume it's an ideal gas, so you have that the pressure is the density times the temperature over the mass. Then you get a relatively simple equation, and in principle, everything here is directly observable. You can, in principle, measure the temperature as a function of radius if you have good enough data. And you can, in principle, measure the density. But in practice, the data isn't good enough for that. So typically assume that it's isothermal, roughly, and get a simpler equation. So it looks like this, where the velocity dispersion for the baryons, let's say, is sigma b squared. I'll be assuming that it's the same for matter and the baryons, which also isn't really good. But it doesn't really affect much of what I have to say. If you assume this, then they get they have the same profile. So the baryons and the dark matter have the same profile. This doesn't hold, obviously, if you assume that they have different variants, different velocity variants. But in this case, you get the equation that's very simple. In the other case, there's just one more parameter. That's the ratio of the variance of the velocities that tell you how the two profiles are related. So that's a parameter that's usually included in the fit. But for the argument, really, here there's a profile. You can solve this equation. It's fixed because the f of 0 is just 1 because we're defining it as rho matter as a function of r divided by rho matter at the center. So by definition, it's 1. And by analyticity, it should start quadratic in r squared. So f prime of 0 has to be 0. So there's really only a single parameter profile for the gas. And so in principle, if you measure the core radius from the X-ray image and the temperature from the spectrum, you can measure the matter density and the luminosity, as I said, is quadratic to the baryon density. Once you know the profile, you can plug that in and measure the total luminosity, so you can measure the baryon density. And this was done quite a while ago, Einstein Observatory. Here there's an abstract. And you see this is kind of what the data looks like. So you can measure the for Abel 2255. Here's what newer data looks like. And you can do this exercise and try to measure the gas fraction. So rho baryon at 0 divided by rho matter at 0 from this data. And you see that the hot gas fraction is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.15, but it's definitely not 1. So whatever is in the cluster, not all of it emits X-rays. So there is stuff in addition to the ordinary baryons in the clusters. We see that from the X-ray. We'll also see that there's good indication from the cosmic microwave background that there's stuff beyond baryonic matter. So also to explain the cosmic microwave background, there has to be some additional form of matter around. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the dark matter. For the dark energy, I mean, we can then ask, well, is there anything else beyond matter? For quite a while, people thought, okay, this is probably it. So the universe is somehow omega matter equals 1, and that's it. But you can try to really measure what's there by measuring the shape of the luminosity distance. We already saw that we used the luminosity distance to measure the Hubble parameter. This comes from the normalization, but we can also just measure the shape or the functional form as a redshift of z. This is something that allows us to measure the composition of the universe. So here R, we can write in this form. I hope that makes sense. I mean, it's just because we have a metric. Let's write it as d squared is minus dt squared plus a of t squared, and then dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus dot, dot, dot. We're really just interested in a photon that comes to us radially, so we can ignore this piece. And a photon travels along null shear d6, so we just have dt is plus minus a dr, or dr is plus minus dt over a, so we're just writing the co-moving distance as an integral over the time from the time at which it's emitted to the present. And then this is the kind of gymnastics that you also have to do a lot in this context, we just say the dt I can write as dA over A times H, because H is A dot over A, so the A's cancel. This is 1 over A dot, which is then the dA's. And anyway, so you know how to change variables. It gives you these relations, so you can write the luminosity distance as a function of redshift in this form. And we also know how to write this guy from the Friedmann equation, so we can write the luminosity distance as a function of redshift in this form. So it's omega lambda. If there's dark energy, there's some contribution here. If we have a spatial curvature, there would be an omega k times 1 over z prime squared. If we have matter, there's the piece that redshifts like 1 over a cubed, which means as the redshift increases, the energy density in the matter goes up like 1 plus z cubed. There's the radiation that goes like the fourth power. And you see that the Hubble parameter only enters as an overall factor. Or put differently, if you take the log of this, then it just appears as an additive constant. And so if you plot the log of the luminosity distance as a function of the redshift. This just shifts the curve up and down. So if you're not interested in this overall constant, then you can use the shape to extract information about the cosmological parameters without knowledge of a distance measurement, which is nice because that's the most difficult part. And there were a number of groups that, two main groups working on this. One is the Supernova Cosmology Project, which I'm showing here. And they here I'm showing their first measurement. It's from August 96. And here you see that the statement was that omega lambda is 0.06 plus 0.28 minus 0.34 or less than 0.51 at the 95% confidence level. So they were kind of limiting the amount of dark energy that could be there. In the meantime, another group was working on similar observations, the HiSeas Supernova Search Team, and published their first paper in May 98, where they claim the detection of dark energy. So they say, well, or strong evidence, depending on exactly what you're looking at. They quote omega lambda greater 0 at 3 and 4 sigma. If you assume that the universe is flat, it's between 7 and 9 sigma, and so on for the different fitting methods. So this group then claimed that there was dark energy. This was the plot, so you can make plots based on what I described. You can just fit this to the data. So you measure the luminosity distance using supernovae the way we had discussed. And you see that you get contours that look like this. So the best fit is somewhere here, relatively low matter density, and omega lambda clearly different from zero. And after that, shortly after that, the same year, the other team came back and also confirmed or saw this evidence for dark energy. And so since then, we have a pretty good idea that there isn't just ordinary matter and dark matter, but there's also some amount of dark energy in the universe. We don't really know what it is, but it's somehow there and it's affecting the expansion rate of the universe. So what it is, figuring out what it is, exactly how it behaves, is one of the big goals still in cosmology. Here is what the more recent data looks like, the most recent data looks like from the joint light curve analysis from a few different teams. So these are all observations of supernovae. These are all data points. So you see there's a fair amount of data, and you can constrain the cosmological parameters quite well. There's also measurements out to fairly high redshift for this, and you can measure the cosmological parameters, omega matter and omega lambda, quite well from these measurements in omega curve. And so the other pieces, the other data sets, we'll still have to discuss. So far we've discussed the blue blob. Eventually we'll have to talk about the cosmic microwave background and baryon acoustic oscillations to understand the other contours in this plot. But I think for today, I'll end here and see if there's any questions maybe about this.
What was C11, the dotted line?
Sorry?
What were the dotted lines on the plot there, C11? It's like it's called.
That's a good question. C11, I'm not sure what C11 is. There's no questions, and I guess we'll continue with in the next lecture at higher redshifts.